Welcome back, everybody. It's Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. It's time to continue our local conversation, but with our panel on the heels of our conversation with the mayor. Joining us once again, it's been absent for a bit, A. Rod Womack. Rod Womack, of course, author of the book Redwood, former owner of the Redwood Grill, activist and bon vivant in our city. Good to have you in the studio, Rod.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark.
Always good to see you. Dr. Kimberly Moffitt's back in the studio again. She's here for the next 2 hours, hour and a half. Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, co-editor of Blackberries and Redbones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair Body Politics in Africana Communities, and co-host and host here on the Mark Steiner Show as well. Good to have you back, Kimberly.
Good morning.
Luke Broadwater joins us once again, reporter of the Baltimore Sun, where he covers Baltimore City Hall and local politics. It's always good to have you back in, Luke. You're becoming a regular. Might as well just pull up a chair and hang out forever.
Thanks for having me again.
Good to have you here. And back again for, it's been a while too, is Rick Vatz. Richard Vatz is a professor of rhetoric and communication at Towson University's Department of Instructional Leadership and Professional Development, author of the only authentic book of persuasion, The Salience Agenda, Meaning Spin Model. Good to have you back in the studio.
Hey, Mark. How you doing, bud?
I'm very well. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at talk@steinershow.org. You can also tweet us at Mark Steiner or get on our Facebook pages. But do call in 410-319-8888. There's a lot to talk about in our community about what's going on. But let's start with the polls that the Sun just did and what they say about where we are in Maryland, both in terms of our love, distrust, support of Mayor Hogan, Governor Hogan. That was a real slip, Governor Hogan.
Sometimes he acts like Mayor Hogan, right?
Governor Hogan, and also the divide in terms of how we look at police and more in the city. But and so you've been heart and soul in this, in the middle of all this. So let me start with you, and if you can just, Luke, give us your analysis.
Sure. Yeah. I wrote a piece last week that showed a big divide between state voters and city voters on a number of police issues. And I think they're really sort of dramatic when you look at the difference. As we see the Freddie Gray case starting to go to trial this week, we see that Marilyn Mosby, the state's attorney, is wildly popular in Baltimore. I mean, 3-1 Baltimore voters approve of the job Marilyn Mosby is doing. Mm-hmm. But if you go to Marylanders, more Marylanders than not disapprove of Marilyn Mosby. So you can see a great divide there right in those categories. And then another big divide is with the police. You have almost 2-1 Marylanders prefer police to protesters. They sympathize more with police. But in Baltimore, that number is almost even. It's a slightly in favor of police to protesters. But you can see there's a lot of mixed emotions and almost even support for either side.
So what does that say to you as we approach, especially these trials coming up, starting today? They're starting the jury selection and the voir dire process, which we'll be talking about, by the way, folks. I'm going to just say a quick digression here that we'll be covering this with some intensity. Many of our usual guests here on this program, like Doug Colbert and others, are in the trials every day. They'll be joining us, hopefully, with almost daily reports. We'll be taping with them at the end of the day to give you a report on what happened. But, hey, Rod.
Back to the point about Governor Hogan, it's not a surprise to me, actually, his popularity. I think I read it was 63% mm-hmm. of the voters. I think it's indicative of the amount of Democratic votes that he actually picked up during the elections. And it's clear that he picked them up because I don't see how he could have been voted in had he not picked them up. So I think what we're seeing is, it's an extended honeymoon. There's a number of things that may have extended that honeymoon, maybe what he's gone through, you know, as far as, you know, cancer and being so public about it. And in fact, it looks like he's beat it, you know, to a large extent. And that's huge for a lot of people. And it plays into, I think, the way that they look at him. But I also just think that he's won over some Democrats. And I know some Democrats personally that voted Republican for the first time ever when they voted for him. So I think that's, you know, what we're seeing is just more of what the public wanted to see change. And I think that's, you know.
There's also a huge drop off in the numbers of Democrats who voted.
Right.
In this last election, Kimberly would disagree. I mean, just in Prince George's County, Charles County, Montgomery County, Baltimore City, the numbers of Democratic voters who stayed home was almost equivalent to the numbers by which Governor Hogan won.
Yeah, we had very little to invest in terms of the Democratic candidate. And so a number of people just made the decision not to participate in the process. It's not one that I would advocate for, but it's certainly one that I think a number of voters just made the conscious decision that this is not possible for Anthony Brown. And so there's nothing to go to the polls for. And that certainly worked in Hogan's favor.
I also think that Governor Hogan has what I call a businessman ethos. That is, he comes across as ingenuous. He doesn't come across as overly political, even though that he was, of course, political. And so when you had Anthony Brown attacking him as dangerous and radical repeatedly.
That was a huge mistake. Right.
It was a huge mistake because
it just didn't ring true. Lots of mistakes.
It didn't ring true with the electorate. And I think that also when he dealt with the mayor, with the riots, I think he did not appear as a person who was eager to put her down, to show a difference politically. And I think people therefore inferred this is an ingenuous governor, and we can trust him. And I think that that has worked for him and supports him as well.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. I think in a political sense, though I want to get into something else here, in a political sense, it bodes for tough times in 3 years if this continues for the Democrats to find anybody who can take that on and give people a reason to change.
Yeah, and he's receiving very positive attention nationally. I mean, the New York Times had a column praising him in just in Sunday's paper. And that did talk about tone and how he has struck. He'll have similar positions to other Republican governors, but he won't do it in sort of the rabid anti-Democrat way that other Republican governors will. And that has sort of found a little sweet spot in the electorate here in Maryland.
He watches his shots. I mean, that piece in the New York Times referred to the fact that he will take a shot at Martin O'Malley. And Martin O'Malley is kind of unpopular now in Maryland, relatively speaking. And so he doesn't attack all Democrats all the time. He'll choose his shots, and that seems to work for him.
Yeah. Well, let's be honest, too. The lowering of tolls really does work in his favor as well. I mean, I think we're talking about him as this grandiose figure that is moving and shaking and doing so many strategic moves that seem to work for a number of voters. But at the end of the day, also, my pocketbook is fuller as a result of entering and exiting this state. And that makes a difference for people as well.
Yeah, I think it does. Psychologically, if nothing else, right?
Absolutely.
It may not even
steal
it, though.
Yeah, repealing of the rain tax. Wasn't that another
stormwater
one? Stormwater.
Runoff, yeah.
Runoff, I'm sorry. Stormwater
runoff. No, but yeah. The people who oppose it call it the rain tax.
Right. Yeah.
No, that was genius political branding.
Yeah, that was.
Like, I interview the mayor all the time, and she calls the rain tax now, and she's a supporter of it. The rain tax just sticks.
Right. Like, it was like the risk Obama took when he called it Obamacare.
Mm-hmm. Right,
you know,
right.
I mean, yeah, kind of, right. Let's do that.
It's interesting to me a couple of things here. One is that it's interesting how much the national media, think about the New York Times and its amount of coverage of Baltimore, the Guardian it comes out of London, England, covering Baltimore in a major way, and I've just hired a full-time reporter here in Baltimore, Baynard Woods, who used to work as editor of the city paper, is now working full-time for the Guardian, covering Baltimore.
Reuters has a Baltimore reporter now, Donna Owens.
Right, and so there's a lot happening here that is part, I think, out of the uprisings around Freddie Gray's death and that, but I think it's interesting that they're fixating on Baltimore and Maryland, not usually a state that gets fixated upon. Hey, Rod?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Freddie Gray situation was international. It was a big story, and I'm not suggesting that was any bigger than any other story like it, because there's lots of stories like Freddie Gray all over the country. I think the way that the situation played out into full-fledged riots, and how long those riots lasted, how it impacted Baltimore, you know, and then how we adjusted as a city. I think all of that focused a lot of international attention on our city, and so you know, but we've been an example for better or worse. Of what happens, you know, in situations like that. I think we did some things right after the Freddie Gray situation, and I think that during it we did some things, and after we did some things wrong. And I think that, it's important, and I'm glad that the world is focused on it, A, because it raises this issue to a level that it needed to be raised. But also, it's giving other cities and other places, hey, look, this is an idea of the things you do right if something like this happens, and this is what you don't do. This is what you do, you don't do if you have a situation like that.
Let me tell you one other thing that Governor Hogan has done. He said in his campaign that there were certain social issues which were settled. This is a very unusual thing for a candidate to say, and it worked for him. And I think that this works particularly in Maryland, where you have a lot of progressive voters, where a candidate says, listen, I know there are issues that are very dear to you and which we've already voted on, we've already passed on, we've already adjudicated, and I'm not going to take those issues on because I consider those settled. And so when a Republican who is like a Howard Baker Republican, which is what I consider myself and Governor Hogan, says that there are a number of issues which I now will consider settled and will not even bring up, I think it relaxes Democrats in this state to say, all right, let's see what kind of person this is. And it's very consistent with the way he's been all along.
I think that's got a lot of truth to it. National attention has also been focused on, as I was thinking about, Atlantic Monthly put up the Carol Ott video about housing, who is a local housing activist, and that went national, the Atlantic Monthly. And so, I mean, there's something afoot here in terms of looking at this city in some ways as a microcosm of what is ailing this nation and what we can do to change
it. Well, is that any different than what David Simon said years ago in terms of his decision to tell the story of any city in America through the eyes of Baltimore? So we saw it then on a 5-season HBO series to say this is not just about Baltimore. This is certainly a microcosm of an American urban city or urban center that needs to be looked at, because so much of the issues that are occurring here are very endemic and occurring in other cities like ours. And so Baltimore becomes a spot where we can kind of shine the light on to say what is really going on here. But I also think what makes us somewhat different is, in particular with the Freddie Gray case, is we're now in a space where we're starting to do jury selection to actually hear the cases of these six individuals and whether or not they cause or are culpable in his death. That's not happening in many of the other police brutality cases that we are hearing at this level. And so I think that's another reason why, in particular, The Guardian, who I'm a fan of, as well as many other national and international media are starting to focus on us.
So folks, 410-319-8888. What are your thoughts and ideas? Freddie Gray's trial is beginning. The Freddie Gray trials are beginning. They're beginning today. Officer Porter being starting today with the voir dire and jury selection over the next several days. Todd Oppenheim had an attorney with not legal aid but the public defender's office, wrote an interesting op-ed in the New York Times.
And a candidate for judge.
Candidate for judge in the circuit court, which is really interesting. See a young guy like that jumping in to raise the issues, which I think is important to have people come in and do that, because it's always like a slam dunk. And to have somebody available to push the issues, though the judges will not debate. We tried to do that last time that happened. They won't come on air to debate the other candidates, but we'll give them voice in the course of this election. I think it's important. But what he raised in that was, which I found really interesting, is the difference between how these cases were handled before for the police in terms of the police getting really low bails, being able to get in and out of jail quickly, not being forced to stay in jail. The speed with which the trial has been put up, 6 months as opposed to a year or more. And the very different treatment people receive, I think, was an interesting kind of point he was bringing up, not to condemn, but to kind of illuminate how unjust, in some ways, our criminal justice system
but
is.
Most protesters are not satisfied by process. They are satisfied by outcome. And so as this trial progresses, I'll be very interested if the process appears to be sterling and proper, if that will be sufficient, because I don't think it will. I think the issue will be outcome.
Yeah, Oppenheimer's point was, and I started to read it and I thought, well, he's saying that they're getting special treatment, right? But when you get to the end, what he's really saying is they're getting fair treatment and everyone else is getting screwed.
Right.
And you think about
– That's an important point.
Yeah, you think about $250,000 bail, $350,000 bail for the officers charged in this case. It is important to note that not everybody is accused of murder in this case. Only one officer is. Many of the others are accused of reckless endangerment. But that was those bails were lower than a young protester who had jumped in a police car and kicked in the window, and he had a $500,000 bail. So people saw a big disparity in that between people perhaps involved in a death and somebody who was accused of smashing a police car.
Anyone want to jump in? Please do.
I think also the comparison of background. That article makes no effort to compare. It compares treatment, but it doesn't compare background. I mean, you know, do they have prior charges? Have they been in difficulty with the police?
Well, but I think that's been done so many times. I mean, the report's pretty thorough and pretty clear that people are languishing in our city jails, in our county jails, not being able to get bail, even if the bail is only $1,000 because people can't afford to even find $100 in their homes to get people out, and are often – what was the number we saw? I'm trying to remember the exact number. I wish Doug Colbert could call him right now and give me the number. We can look it up very quick. But it's a huge number, 60% or more of the cases, after people spend a month to a year in prison, charges are dropped.
Yes,
that's what he was.
Yeah. I used to cover the city court system for 3 years, and you would never see a case go to trial on its first date. It was always postponed and postponed. And one time we ran the numbers, and we had people that whose cases had been postponed for 10 years.
Wow!
So you have these people sitting around. I'm not sure if everybody was held in jail that time, but after a long enough time sitting in jail, you almost don't need a trial because no matter what. What the penalty could be, it will be time served.
Right.
So people are just willing to plead guilty to get out.
410-319-8888. Your thoughts? I want to hear what's your thoughts on all this. I mean, we're entering this phase of these trials are going to be beginning between now and April, which will be the year anniversary of the death of Freddie Gray, and it will be intense. I mean, I think that people are looking at these trials and not sure – none of us are sure what the outcome of these trials can be or what they might be. Judge Williams, I've been doing a lot of coverage on him in The Sun and other places about who he is, that he was a prosecutor in police cases. But, you know, to a person, people think that he's a – not to a person, but many people think he's a really fair and reliable judge. And most judge attorneys you talk to say, as defense attorneys – Or as prosecuting attorneys, they like appearing before him because he gives lawyers a chance to really argue their cases, which is not always the case. So,
yeah, when you read about his about his past, his biography, you find that what most people say about him is that he's fair, that he's sharp, that he understands the law, but that he's super aggressive about how he approaches cases that he's been involved in. And it sounds like that's exactly the kind of person, someone that brings that kind of expertise, that brings that kind of passion, if you will, to the job. I think that it's important that, you know, we have a judge that's got experience, that's been a prosecutor, that's prosecuted police before, and he's been on the investigating side of it, too. So he understands that process as well. And I just think that in terms of fairness and parity in this system, you know, of justice that we have, that's a good way to start. To your point about process versus outcome, I don't know if I fully agree with you. I think that, you know, in the beginning of this whole situation with Freddie Gray, then that would have been more of an issue. OK, but the fact that charges were pressed on six police officers and they've been charged shows that it's not so much just about process, quote unquote, but there's also some real outcome. Now, whether that means they'll get any jail time or whatever is a whole different issue. But I think by and large, we're going to see a public that's going to be pretty satisfied as long as that process continues to play out the way it is.
And this particular first trial is going to be one that will
set the stage.
Because if he cooperates with the state,
yes,
and turns state witness, that changes the nature of all the cases coming afterwards, mm-hmm, which we'll be talking about this week. And mm-hmm, if he's convicted, that will set the stage for perhaps other convictions down the road. And will also, if he's not convicted, the same will be true in the other way. I mean, I think that this is a very tense time.
Yeah.
For everybody on all sides of this issue.
Well, you talked about the disparity in Mosby's popularity in the city vis-a-vis the state. Do you envision any outcome that could either make her less popular in the city or more popular in the state?
No. That's a tough question. Probably not.
No, yeah, I don't think so. I think the bigger question here for me is that the perceptions of two perceptions. Let's just start with this one since we raised it on Marilyn Mosby and how people perceive her. I'm not surprised that we have, and we can please tackle this one, that a young African-American woman elected a state's attorney, youngest person in the United States, who then one of her first acts is to indict police officers. I think you see why the majority of especially white people in the state and the country see her as a negative force. I mean, that's part of it. We always don't want to talk about that, but right. I think that's it. But I think that is a huge piece of what's happening here. Kimberly?
No, absolutely. And I think that because she was willing to take such a stand in almost a very chutzpah way is also what was off-putting to a number of white constituents. Mm. And she wasn't gracious about it at all. And, I mean, that's up for debate in terms of how you respond to that. But certainly her willingness to clearly say this was problematic and something has to be done about it does rub individuals the wrong way. I often tell the story to my students of my first experience with jury duty here in the city, and it was for a gun charge or maybe an attempted murder charge of a young man, and sitting in the room being asked by the judge the general questions, and one of them was, you know, if it comes down to how you see a story, do you always or do you affirm and support the side of the police officers? And they asked those of us who would affirm that stand to stand. And immediately, I had been in Baltimore all of a year, immediately the disparity was very clear to me because all of the white mm-hmm. individuals in the room were standing and all of us of color were sitting. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, what city am I living in to have such an experience? So to then hear where we are now with Marilyn Mosby is not a shock because it is reflective of exactly what I think many of us see about the judicial system and criminal justice system.
It breaks down a lot among color lines and even and ideological lines. And if you combine them, it's very drastic. So Marilyn Mosby is most popular among statewide African Americans who approved her 69% to 17%, which is just huge. That's bigger than Hogan. That's you know, perhaps the most popular politician in the state among African Americans. Among Maryland Republicans, 11% approve, 69% disapprove. It's right. It's the exact inverse.
Right.
And that's much harsher than Maryland whites or Maryland Democrats or Marylanders as an average. So it's when you add in a different race, and then a different ideology, which is basically a very pro-police ideology, then you have...
So how do the other two... just say, curious numbers of the polling. What comes out with the majority of white people and with Democrats?
White people is 69% approve, 49% disapprove.
Of Mosby. Approve.
Two to one disapprove of whites.
All right.
about 2-1 Democrats approve. About 2-1 Democrats approve.
Yeah, that's...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, yeah.
But African-Americans is like 5-1 for Mosby, so...
It's fascinating because, you know, we're still... and have always been the most northern-southern state. And
the most southern-northern state.
The most northern-southern state.
And the most southern-northern
state. Southern-northern state, yes, you're right.
Both.
Right, both, you're right. And, you know, so absolutely I agree with you, Kim, that it comes to no shock to me and I'm sure to many other people because, you know, first, Baltimore is just – and I'm not from Baltimore, but I'm from Maryland, and it just still surprises me how racially polarized the city is and how unbelievably polarized the state is and how much it has not changed. It's like we're stuck in mud, and we can't get over these ideological gaps or social gaps or socioeconomic issues that kind of keep us separated.
I think we have to take a break here and come right back, and we get to the phones as well. Ed and Clarence, we get your calls, 410-319-8888, and I would just pause and wait a break. We're stuck in the mud of the history of America. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner for our local news roundup and roundtable here with A-Rod Womack, author at Redwood, and a Baltimore businessman and community activist, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, professor of American Studies at University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and co-editor of Blackberries and Redbones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body Politics, and Africana Communities, as well as being a co-host and guest host here on The Mark Steiner Show. Luke Broadwater, reporter for the Baltimore Sun, covering the city's city hall and local politics, and Dr. Richard Vatz, professor of rhetoric and communication at Towson University. Department of Instructional Leadership and Professional Development, author of The Only Authentic Book of Persuasion, also been a guest on the show for the last 22 years. 410-319-8888 is the number. Can I go right to the phones? Is that okay with everybody? Let's go right. Ed, you're on the air, line one.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, Ed. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm actually calling about reckless, absent-minded treatment of citizens, and this is related to the MTA, and I know this is maybe a little bit off topic of what y'all were talking about, but the MTA has a bus facility on Kirk Ave in a residential area, allegedly causing all kinds of health problems for its residents, and I'm just wondering why these facilities are not being pushed into non-residential areas and why that's not an issue, and, you know, I mean, where they'd cause much less harm and much less of a problem. I mean, I've been to MTA meetings, and they have no proof that the new facility that they're bringing in is even going to change anything. It's just, you know, they're slapping a new paint job on it and calling it something else. You know, and it seems like, you know, it's a non-headline-grabbing type of thing, but I think it's just as important, and I feel like we'd be interested to see these types of topics come up more in terms of the day-to-day health of our citizens.
I think those are great topics. I'm sorry you didn't get through when the mayor was on. I know that's what you wanted to say, but we couldn't get to your call then. I don't have anything quite – I mean, I think that's part of the issue we raised with her around Curtis Bay, and I was a little flabbergasted that shocked actually that the mayor couldn't comment on the incineration plant. That's a huge issue in that community and more of those health issues when we talk about climate, but be that as it may, maybe that's one of the reasons that our mayor was so low in the polls, as we were talking about during the break.
Sure. Yeah, I don't know that much about this issue at Kirk Avenue, but if you want to give me your number, I'll happy to give you a call and
good.
Look into it more.
It's always good to have a reporter in the house here.
Sometimes.
I would just say that when mayors are not running against for office, they have a little less patience with what they don't wish to talk about.
Well, people always had a lack of patience with me and what I want to talk about, whether they're running or not. 410-319-8888. So I wonder what – let's get a quick call in here. Then I do want to kind of wrestle a little bit with why we think the mayor's numbers are so poor and what that says about this race coming up. 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks, Mr. Steiner. Good morning, folks.
Good morning.
You know, I would say, of course, the police would have more popularity in areas outside the city. Outside the city, because those police officers are their neighbors. They live in the community. The added sense of security for those police officers that work in the city but live in those communities give those folks an added sense of security. They're there to added protection in the communities where they live at, as opposed to what they do in Baltimore City. You know, so that's a simple answer. Those police officers have a different role in the city when they're doing their job as opposed to where they live at. You know, it's an extension of that. And those people in Brooklyn, in that part of Curtis Bay, they don't count, Mr. Steiner. That's why that's going to happen. You know, thank you.
Thank you, Clarence. I think that is part of it. In Curtis Bay, they have more of these plants than any other part of our city. It's one of the poorest, most deindustrialized sections of our city. Poor white and black people living in that community. And I think that is – but you've also seen an incredible movement being built that high school students started, but that's a talk for another day. So what about, very quickly, the poll, why Stephanie Lawrence-Blake is – why we think she was so low down in the polls and what that says about this race?
Yeah, I mean, we asked people whether they would consider voting for her again, and 71% of Baltimore voters said they would not. She had 22% said they would. And what we noticed the most from the poll is that the people –
of course, in that primary, you might win with that number.
Perhaps, yeah.
That's
so I guess she's in first place, actually.
Yeah. Right, they put you in first place, right.
But what we noticed was the people who disapproved of Rawlings-Blake the most were the most supportive of Sheila Dixon.
Wow.
So Sheila Dixon was benefiting the most from the anti-Stephanie Rawlings-Blake vote.
Well, let me just say,
Rick, go ahead.
When she said we've got to give the rioters' room to destroy. And then she said, when somebody said, my God, how could you say that? She said, I didn't say that. Then she said she didn't mean that. And then further, when she called the rioters thugs, and then she retracted calling them thugs. People felt that you didn't have a strong leader who was outraged by the rioters. I mean, whatever else position you must take as a leader, you've got to be outraged by rioters. And you cannot have the city council have a press conference in which you have some of the Bloods at the press conference. I mean, there may have been some people who were very good friends with them who said that's a good idea, but I don't know anybody who was not outraged by that. And I think that these sorts of symbols, when you have other politicians who are rejecting these and are public about rejecting these, I think they cripple your popularity and cripple it permanently.
You've got one person who disagrees. I mean, I wasn't outraged by it. I wasn't outraged by it first, and I'm not going to spend too much time talking about that because that's really not what I want to comment about. But I'll say this: anytime you can bring a group that is perceived as negative into any kind of positive movement, positive light for the city to help quell a riot, I don't care who it is, I'm all for it. Like, hands up, I'm for it. So I'll say that. But what I want to say is I think some of Mayor Stephanie Rowland Blake's issues about her popularity just are much deeper. And I think it just goes to her ability or lack of ability to connect with enough people on enough levels. A lot of people who I know who are in business, who are not in business, just don't feel like they can connect with her. They do not feel like she is kind of on their wavelength for one reason or another. And they don't believe that really that her passion is in this. Like, that's what I hear from a lot of people. And I think that's what it really comes down to more than anything.
Dr. Moffitt? I would agree. I see it as a sheer disconnect with constituents across the board. And she has not been able to effectively create that linkage or connection. I remember taking my children to the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday parade the same year that Sheila Dixon had been indicted. And she still walked in that parade, and the revelry around all of the individuals still rooting for her and calling out her name. That is not a connection that that Stephanie Rowland Blake has ever had with Baltimore constituents. And that extends into the business community, because she's rubbed them the wrong way.
Yes.
It also extends into the police department as well as the school system.
Right.
I mean, so you're talking about these major entities or units that she's responsible for, that there has never been this sheer connection to say, I'm your leader and we're in this together. Yeah.
Business community is really down on Stephanie Rowland Blake.
I've said this before, but I think it's worth saying again that Sheila Dixon and Stephanie Rowland Blake have a classic contrast in styles. And if we were to judge this election based solely on spontaneous applause in the street, Sheila Dixon wins hands down. That said, as I called voters for these stories, I asked them, why don't you like Stephanie Rowland Blake? And a lot of what they said, and this may seem like a weird comparison, but were similar to criticisms of Jeb Bush, which are sort of like, she doesn't seem like she wants to do the job that much. She's always, she seems sort of not into it, or... And Trump would say not high energy. And I think that may even get to what Professor Vatz was talking about with her sort of seeming to be on both sides of some issues and not really taking a stand and showing people she really wants to do this and really has a strong feelings about it.
And how unfortunate, considering she is seen as a Baltimore darling,
right?
I mean, this is home for her. This is what she's always wanted to come back to and be a part of. And so her rise to where she is now seems likely. Like, we expect that to happen. But on the other side, what we continue to see is this disconnect where she doesn't seem like she is passionate or connected to the job.
And I think that, you know, when you look at her as well, and you look at Sheila Dixon, that you have to remember her past. I mean, Sheila Dixon grew up in this community as a working class young woman.
Teacher.
Worked in programs. We worked in a program called Baltimore Prep together back in the 70s when she was in her early 20s. And she was also, when she was on the city council, remember her shoe incident? Do you remember that? When she took her shoe off, banged it on the table, saying, now it's our turn, because the majority of the city council for the first time was black. And I think that the majority of African-American voters in the city and in the presence in the city feel left out of the political process, and that she represents, in many ways, you won't be left out if I'm mayor. Mm-hmm. And some people feel that. She's like Barry in D.C. on one count, that he did a lot for his constituents. He was busted on a thing that had nothing to do with politics.
Right.
People still supported him, and he got jobs. He got roads paved. He took care of people's homes.
He took care of the youth.
He got things done. And there's many people who can tout that, and you know, from D.C., and I know some who say it all the time. Marion Barry was the best mayor has ever graced D.C.
That's what they said. They're right. And I remember him, though, as a leader of the Free D.C. movement in the 60s.
Right, yeah.
He was there from the beginning.
But you have to know all that he's done, and I'm one of these people. Look, we're all subject to making mistakes, right? 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 Aren't we? Right? So my point is that, look, he who lives in a glass house, throw the first stone. I'll forgive you.
Let me get a quick call here before we have to end this part of our discussion. 410-319-8888. It's been good. Kenny in Pikesville, you're on the air. Welcome. Hi, Kenny, you there?
Everybody's good? Yeah, I'm here.
Welcome.
Can you hear me?
Well, yes, we can. Welcome.
Thank you. Question for you. Do you think if Mayor Dixon wins again, that she'll be effective because it's perceived that she might not have a good relationship with Washington mm-hmm. because of her indictment? Because, you know, when Kurt Schmoke was mayor, when Mayor Schmoke was mm-hmm. in-house, all he had to do was make a phone call and money was received. I mean, he had a good relationship with people, it was perceived, with Washington. Do you think that would affect her? That's my question.
Quick final thoughts on this before we have to break. I mean, I think that is clearly Senator Pugh's argument that I have connections in Annapolis. I have connections in Washington. I have connections nationwide. I can make this happen. No one else can. That's going to be part of Catherine Pugh's mm-hmm. argument going into this mayoral campaign. Thoughts?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, she was in the First Lady's box during the State of the Union speech. So she
Catherine Pugh.
Yes.
Right.
And if famously people remember that President Obama refused to stand on the same stage with Sheila Dixon right after the indictment. So that could be a winning argument for Catherine Pugh, who's in second place in the polls right now. I do want to say one final thought on Rawlings Blake, which is, I do think that she does deeply care about Baltimore, but has like a terrible time expressing it. And I think it's probably a personal introversion issue.
I think that's probably not incorrect.
Real quick.
Final quick thoughts.
Okay, I met a guy who was getting married for the fifth time. I said, are you sure you're in love with her? Are you in love with getting married? And it's almost like that with politics. I think some politicians, and I'm not calling out anybody in particular, but I think some politicians are in love with the idea of getting the job, winning the job, and not so much doing the work. And I'm leaving it there.
Let me just say quickly, parenthetically, if you look at the integrity of Kurt Schmoke and you contrast it with Sheila Dixon, I mean, you can understand why Sheila Dixon should not be mayor of Baltimore.
Well, and we could easily say that, but we also know what the outcome for Marion Barry was in Washington, D.C. And again, I think what we tend to do is focus on the outcomes of what politicians are able to carry out for their constituents. And if they feel like that person can do it, then they're willing to support it. This is not an endorsement for Sheila Dixon, of course, but just simply to say that I think that is where she rises to be that leader in the polls is the fact that people are relying on or recalling so much of what she did when she was in office and even her trajectory to get to that office.
Now we do have to take a break here. I do appreciate all the comments we had. And we will be having all the mayoral candidates on this program coming up, whether they are on the top of the polls or the bottom of the polls. We have one coming in tomorrow. Nick Mosby is coming in next week. We have a number of people as a round. We'll have them all through between now and April. We'll be doing many one-on-ones with our mayoral candidates so you can make up your own mind about who to vote for. This I and the show take no position on this race. I want to thank our guests, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, who you just heard, who will remain with us for the next part of this program, A-Rod Womack, who is a author of Redwood and a local businessman and activist, Luke Broadwater, reporter for Baltimore Sun, where he covers City Hall and local politics, Dr. Rick Vetz, a longtime guest and old friend, Professor of Rhetoric and Communications at Towson University, author of the only real book of persuasion. Good to have you all with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break and come right back to talk about national politics, starting with what happened in Colorado. Stay with us.